مولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين، لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين، روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. Seems like my voice is not going to cooperate tonight, but inshallah we'll get through it. One of the lessons that we learn, one of the very important lessons that we learn from Imam al-Hussein is this one. The Imam made it very clear for mankind, for the mu'mineen, for those people who were around at that time, that their greatest wajib, the most obligatory of all of their actions of the mu'mineen at that time, was to fight against the taghut of the time. The words of the Imam are this: وَعَلَى الْإِسْلَامَ السَّلَامِ إِذْ قَدْ بُلِيَتِ الْأُمَّةِ بِرَاعٍ مِثْلِ يَزِيدٍ. He says that Islam itself will be finished if the Ummah is tested, is afflicted with a leader like Yazid. So Islam itself will be over. The greatest of our duties and our responsibilities is actually to go and make sure that we remove this tyrant. And it was the duty of everybody. Now, the Imam, after making these things clear, he also moved in that direction to make sure that that happened. But there was a problem. The mu'mineen who were there at that time, the right number of people didn't accompany the Imam. They didn't provide that assistance. They weren't there for the Imam. Now, what happens is that amongst those people were religious and practicing people. We don't want to think that all of those who didn't accompany the Imam of the time were all people who were in the camp of Yazid or couldn't recognize that Yazid was a tyrant. No, some practicing, committed mu'mineen were among the people who stayed behind. This makes it, first of all, it's historically, that's the accurate way of addressing this issue. And secondly, then it makes it a greater lesson for us that, God forbid, we also be like that, that we are people who are practicing and religious, but we don't do what the Imam of the time needs. For us, it's very important to identify what is the greatest of all needs at this particular time and make sure that we and others aren't confused. What happens is that sometimes, I'll give you the example of those people over there first, those individuals, the ones who didn't come, some of them were people like this. If it was made clear to them that your responsibility is to do qiyam, to uprise against the tyrant, and they realized how difficult that would be, what does that mean to go against Yazid with a small group of people like Imam Hussein? When they realized how much trouble that meant and what that would mean for them, for their families, these people were people who would occupy themselves with things of secondary importance. Other good acts, but things of secondary importance. Like what? For instance, Imam Hussein himself, if he had only done bay'ah, if he had only remained in Medina, he could have stayed there and he could have actually taught the people the proofs of the walaya of the Ahlul Bayt, the isma of the Ahlul Bayt. He could have gathered a small group of followers, taught them salah, taught them fasting, ahadith, tafsir, right? All of these things are wonderful. If he didn't go. The Imam also knew that if I go to Iraq, if I go to Karbala, I won't be able to take care of the orphans. I won't be able to teach the people their basic ahkam, right? But the Imam sacrificed those minor things for that which was more important. That was what he was supposed to do. Those other mu'mineen were people who would do that though. Occupy themselves with things which are less important. One of the reasons that we will have problems, meaning one of the things that will delay the return of the Imam, is if we continue to be like this. If we're not people who look to see what is our most important responsibility at this time. If we're people who can't tell. I can't tell what's actually really important, what isn't important, what's of secondary importance, what Islam really needs at the moment. If I can be distracted, then that's when it comes to serious problems. Now, in these majalis, what we try and do is talk about things that in our own minds, come up as things of strategic importance, things that we need to work on, areas that aren't necessarily the best in the community. We've got to work on these issues, and we're going to be trying to discuss some of them, inshallah, tonight. We're reminded, though, of that hadith of the Imam. If we do work on things of secondary importance, when we have other things of greater importance that we should be focused on, and we remain focused on the smaller things, there is no proximity that is gained to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Instead of me doing my proper duty, I focus all of my energy on something which is not as important. Instead of those things which are more important, at that time I can't gain any divine proximity. The hadith is this. It says, "La qurbata bin nawafil idha adharrat bil fara'id." There is no proximity that we gain by doing recommended acts when they cause us to leave and abandon our wajibat, those things that God really wants and really needs. Because there's different messages even that are given to us as Shias right now. We have to, as mu'mineen, find out what's the correct message, what are the more important things, how should we occupy ourselves, we're youth, we have energy, how can we go over and serve the cause in the best way possible. Now, what we were talking about was the idea of the proper Islamic training, right? The verse of the Holy Quran that we are actually discussing is this one from Surah Yusuf. This is the last night, inshallah, that we'll be talking about this, and we'll be moving on. It's verse number 96 from the Surah. This is what he says, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَلَمَّا أَنْجَاءَ الْبَشِيرِ When the bearer of good tidings came to Ya'qub alayhi salam, أَلْقَى عَلَى وَجْهِهِ Alqahu ala alwajhi, he cast the shirt of Yusuf on the face of Yaqub, fartadda basira, and Yaqub, his sight returned. Qala alam aqul lakum inni a'lamu min Allah ma la ta'lamun. After that, Yaqub told them that, did I not know, did I not tell you that I know from Allah that which you don't know? Okay, so what were you using this verse as a reminder of was the idea that Yaqub, by his patience, by his sabr, by his taqwa, Yusuf, by his patience and taqwa, were able to do something where they were able to save this other group of mu'mineen who had made mistakes, bring them back to the right path, and save their family, and then after that do work for Islam. Where we moved on from that was the idea of having strong, thriving Muslim families as being one of our strategic points. One of our most important lines of defense. One of the heavy responsibilities that we've been given is the responsibility of not only making sure that we do the right thing, but that our children and our families do the right thing. The verse of the Holy Quran is this, in Surah 66, verse number 6. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا قُوا أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا That, O you who believe, make sure you protect yourselves and your families from the fire. It's not enough that you are protected from the fire. You have to make sure that your families, those who are around you, for us who are now in the crowd, if we're a father or a mother, then we want to make sure we're protecting our children. If we're a brother or a sister, we want to make sure that we're protecting our siblings, our own parents, right? Everybody who's around us. We want to make sure that we're trying to bring everybody in the right way. So he said that our red line, the issue that we couldn't compromise, in my words, the qusair of our time, was the idea that we were going to make sure that we protected the family, that we didn't break the family unit, that we had healthy, thriving families. And we talked before about the idea of actually experiencing marital bliss. Now, we're not going to go back to that topic. Just remind ourselves of one of Jazakumullah khairan. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. We're going to remind ourselves of one of our responsibilities, and that is when it comes to doing the duties that we have towards husband and wife, the verse of Quran tells us that we are libas for one another. We're clothing for one another. Right? This verse of the Quran, it says in Surah Baqarah, verse 187. Hunna libasun lakum wa antum libasun lahunna. That you are libas, you're clothing for them, and they are clothing for you. We want to make sure that no matter what happens on the outside world, or no matter how our spouses are dealing with us, that we make sure that we do our responsibility towards Allah by protecting them, by bringing them to the right way, by making sure that we fulfill all of our duties towards them. It's not the case that because of us not doing our duties, our spouses end up exposed to shaitan and taken off the path. Absolutely important. Now for us, the other thing we had started talking about the other day, and I didn't get a chance to complete this topic, was the idea of how to raise Muslim children. Of course, a topic like this is much more vast than something that can be covered in a lecture of 45 minutes. These are reminders, things for us to remember, a hadith we may have heard before, but then the real duty is on us to find out, well, what are the Islamic principles when it comes to child rearing? To know that we are responsible. The verse told us we had to protect ourselves and our families from the fire. We want to make sure that we know what the rules are. What has God said when it comes to our children? These are good for us to hear even as children too. It's not that, okay, that's a discussion for the adults. No, all of us should be hearing these things and should be moving in that direction. Some of the things that we say are actually different to things you find in the West. For instance, there's the emphasis for our children for the first 7 lunar years that we grant them freedom. Let's read the hadith together. It says, Al-waladu sayyidun sab'a sinin. That for the first 7 years, the child is the sayyid. The child is the master. If we really want to go back to Islamic principles, we also need to have a community that will even find this acceptable. The idea that our children for the first 7 years are a little bit naughty. Right? If you let a child be a sayyid for the first 7 years, that child will be a little bit naughty. The Ahlul Bayt have given us some red lines though. They've told us 2 things that we learned from the students of the Ahlul Bayt, from ulama, 2 things to avoid. One of them is during these first 7 years, when I've been told to give a child freedom for the first 7 years, if the child is going to do something that's dangerous, in the hadith, there's a child and he's playing with a sharp metal object. And Imam Ali, even though he believes in the idea of freedom for the first 7 years, he takes that away, he throws that away. We're not going to allow our children, even for those first 7 years, to endanger themselves. Islamically speaking, that freedom for the first 7 years, whatever the child wants to do, no. There's another thing that again limits the freedom of the child for the first 7 years. If it comes to something which is ugly for a child to do. Ugly for a child to do. For instance, some of you may have toddlers, right? What a wonderful time that is when you have really small children. One of the things that children love to do is to play with their food. Little kids play with their food. Now with some parents, because they want to be neat and clean and they know that it's not nice to be messy, they'll go over and they'll enforce this with the child. Right? The child is 1 year old, 2 years old. They like to play with the food. And the parents over there, you'll see some moms, as soon as the child's eating and kind of putting their hands on the food and stuff like that, keep wiping the child's mouth. Right? They end up taking all the pleasure away from the food. The child likes that. They enjoy that. They enjoy making noise with pots and pans. So the mother who's realized that the child's, and of course this is a vast discussion, but he's noticed that the child's supposed to be free. I'm not supposed to limit the freedom of the child for the first 7 years. There are consequences. If I'm a parent who refuses to allow my child to be free, and I'll make my child be orderly and behave like an adult, even though they're 3 or 4, what are the consequences? What happens? What price does my child pay? So if a parent is like that, let's say there's a mother and she knows that the child's supposed to be free for the first 7 years, she has to plan accordingly, right? Make sure that the pots and pans which are at the disposal of the kids are ones that if he bangs them, they won't break. So I won't put glass, for instance, at the child's disposal. I'll make sure there's metal pots. But the house will be nice and noisy. Children like to play with water. They like to play with dirt. We have a hadith about how dirt is rabi'u sibyan, right? It's good for them to be playing with dirt, right? So now as a parent, now I have to be thinking, okay, how is it that I can grant freedom, limit their thing, be a playmate with the child also, guide them to what's right, but not the case that I come down like a ton of bricks and I make them conform. For 7 years, the child's supposed to be free. The next 7 years, though, for those of you who are past that 7 years, from that until 14, we have a different thing to do with you. Right? Let me not say that, right? You guys still stay friends with me for a second. For the first 7 years, we'll go back to the first 7 years, and I'm going to go, what do we do for the next 7 years? What should you expect from your parents? For the first 7 years, we also want to make sure that we play with our children. Let me read you this hadith. It says, Dar ibnaka yal'ab sab'a sinin. Allow your child to play for the first 7 years. To play. That's the child's fitri need. They're supposed to be playing more than that. What you're supposed to do as a parent is play games with your child. Play games with your child. As a father, as a mother, ideally for you as a parent also, when you're, I'm summarizing the lessons that we learned from the ulama. They say when you play games with your child, don't play games like an adult. Imam Ali says, whoever has a small child, behave childishly with them. Right? So don't be giving like, you know, you're giving a university style lecture to your little kid. No. Now it's the time you guys are going and y'all are playing basketball together. Right? You can trash talk. It's okay. A little bit. You're not insulting your kids. Right? But playing physical games with them. Ideally, we like to see mother and father. Right? There's one time when the child goes over and they beg the mother or the father to play. And the father is like, I'm reading a newspaper. I'm listening to, watching TV. Right? The right way to be, though, is that there's Imam Khomeini. Right? Imam Khomeini. He would be over there playing with his grandson. Right? The kids would be playing games. We talk about the idea of freedom. And none of you guys do this, right? None of you are small. Make sure you don't do any of these things, okay? There was a little kid in the first 7 years where we give that freedom, who came running towards Imam Khomeini, and they wanted to hit Imam Khomeini with like a slipper or something like that. And the relative watched what was happening, saw them running towards Imam Khomeini, said, what's happening? He said, I'm going to go hit Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini did. So they were running behind the person, and the child came running into the room with Imam Khomeini, had the slipper, and then Imam Khomeini saw the relatives chasing to grab them. He said, no, let the child go. The little kid came in and tack, hit Imam Khomeini. Then after that, then Imam Khomeini calmed the child down. The first 7 years. The seven years, you have something different. Okay. He calmed the child down. Explained to him, he said that the papers that you wanted to tear up, those belong to other people. Right? From an Islamic point of view, I'm responsible. I can't allow you to tear them up. He calmed the child down. He explained these things. But our reaction, the way we deal with children the first 7 years, absolutely important. The idea of being loving, nurturing, playing games with them. One of the mistakes people make, Western culture is like this. We'll turn on the TV, right? We'll keep the children, so much easier to keep the children occupied and silent. They go in the room, they watch TV. The TV keeps them quiet, it keeps them out of our hair. We can do what we want to do. We can watch TV. Right? That's not the right way to be, though. The right way is engaging the children, playing with the children, talking with the children. And the Prophet was like that. Even with the children of strangers, there's stories where the Holy Prophet would be coming to the masjid and the children would say, no, we want you to play with us. And the Prophet of God would be a camel for the children. Then Salman noticed at the time for the prayer, it was time for prayer, the Prophet's not there. Mu'minin asking, where is the Holy Prophet? They go and they see the Prophet's over there with the children. So of course, with me, I get away from the Prophet. It's time for Salah. Yalla. Right? The Prophet said, no. He said, what you want to do is give these children, ransom me from the children. Give the children something so they'll let me go. They gave the children walnuts and they let the Prophet go. Right? The idea of respecting the children, playing with the children, engaging with the children. So the hadith tells us to play, and we have other examples from the Ahlul Bayt of playing with them. Really important stuff. The easy way out is the TV, but that's also the danger zone. God forbid some of us, we go over and we, for instance, buy an iPad for our children, buy them the latest cell phones, and you know how easy, how the internet works, and what access the person has, and what things they might see. The difficult way is to engage them, to be with them, to spend time with them. That's the difficult way. The easy way out is actually not the right way. So, what happens for the next 7 years? The next 7 years, one of the things, embrace yourselves, guys, is they say, so he should play for 7 years, and after that, abdun sab'asinin. The next 7 years, the child is an abd, is a slave. Not literally. They don't have a whip and chain or anything, but that's when you're supposed to receive instructions. The beautiful thing about those hadith, the hadith tell us, if you allow your child to play for the first 7 years, you allow your child freedom for the first 7 years, the second 7 years, the child automatically, without you doing anything, is ready to receive the training. So the hadith says, let them play, and then after that, you adab. The child becomes mu'addab. The child becomes, he's ready now to receive this training. So those parents who can kind of observe that, they get the right thing out of the child. So for the second 7 years, that's the time when we focus on training the child, the time when we focus on getting the child disciplined. The two things that we did observe, one of them was things which are dangerous and things which are not against social etiquette, things which were ugly even for a child to do in the first 7 years. Child wants to bite somebody. I'm free. I'm going to say it for the first 7 years. I want to bite somebody. No, we don't allow them to do that. Play with their private parts, for instance. We don't allow them to do that. Right? Things that are ugly for a child to do during the first 7 years, absolutely we don't allow. But other things that the child wants to go and do, that's actually tolerable for us. The reason it's a little bit difficult is sometimes when you have children who are a bit more free, they want to run around, then they go to the houses of neighbors, and the neighbors aren't used to that. They're used to the children being controlled, silent, not saying anything. It's a little bit difficult. The cultural revolution will come when we can convince other parents of these Islamic principles. Very important. But the one that I wanted to talk about, remember we were talking about the idea of strategy and what are the most important things. The next thing that we learn for the next 7 years is that it's the time for the child's education. Islam has also given us instructions on that. So it says, Al-Ghulam yala'abu sab'a sinin. For 7 years the child plays. After that, وَيَتَعَلَّمُ الْكِتَابُ سَبْعَ سِنِينَ. After that, the education begins. So educating our children at that stage. For us, before that, we don't even want to force religious education on our children. 7 lunar years. Even religious education, of course we encourage them. They pray with us. They see us praying. They see our interaction with Quran. But the idea of forcing things on them, taking away that right of playing and stuff like that, actually, it's too early for them. Those 7 years are important for their formative years. What we learn from the hadith is that what a child learns when they're young stays with them. I'm building up to what I actually want to talk about. Okay, but there's some pushback normally for what I want to say, so let's go over slowly. The hadith tells us this. The simile of what we learn when we're young, مَثَلُ الَّذِي يَتَعَلَّمَ الْعِلْمِ فِي صِغَرِهِ, he says, كَنَّقْشْ عَلَى الْحَجَرِ. When we learn things in our youth, in those first years, those first formative years, he says, this is like carving on a stone. He says that what we learn later, the things that we learn later, that's like writing on water. Right? How quickly will that disappear? But the stuff that we learn those first 7 years, absolutely important, absolutely necessary, and it stays with you. So now all of those things that we were talking about before, the idea that I can't commit sin in front of my children. The focus of the family is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The idea of my parents are loving to me, appreciate me, care about me, all of those things are going to stay with that child. In addition to that, the hadith tell us this, that the heart of the child, قَلْبُ الْحَدَثْ كَالْأَرْضِ الْخَالِيَةِ. The heart of the child is like an empty field. Whatever is cast in that field, the child will then accept that. It'll grow. The same way if you have a field, it's not occupied with anything. Anything you cast in it, then it'll grow. What happens now is whatever is cast in it will also grow. What I wanted to talk about, the strategic thing that I wanted to discuss, is the idea of Islamic education and Islamic schools. And I want to mention this for us as parents, for us as youth, for us as future leaders, to know exactly what we're doing. This is another one of those red lines, Islamic schools. Normally, for a sheikh, if you go into a community and you start to speak about Islamic schools, there's pushback from the community. There's people who don't like to hear that. There's some people who think when you start talking about making Islamic schools, you're actually questioning their piety, because I went through the public school system. I went through a private school that wasn't Islamic. I made it. I'm a Muslim. I'm practicing. I'm doing the right things. Are you saying I'm not pious? Why would we need to have these schools? But what happens is, if we're going to take and advance the cause, we have to be able to think outside the box. We can't be cliche when it comes to Western education. I remember hearing there was an experiment once that they conducted. They said that once this guy had 5 monkeys. He put them in a cage, and in the cage, on the top of the cage, he had some bananas. Underneath that, he had a ladder. The monkeys are there, and they're all in the cage. So obviously, when they see the bananas, one of the monkeys quickly runs, and it goes up to get the bananas. And what the person who's conducting the experiment does is he sprays that monkey with cold water, knocks the monkey down off the ladder by punishing it. Not only that, he punishes all the other monkeys who are there. So they all get a shot of the cold water. After a little bit, the monkeys calm down. Another monkey tries. He's curious. He goes over there and he tries to get the cold water. They punish that monkey. Not only that monkey, but everybody else. After a while, the monkeys learn nobody's to do that. Then he takes one of the monkeys away. The new monkey comes in. He sees there's a ladder and there's bananas. So he runs quickly, tries to go over there. Now the other monkeys, they've learned what happened, right? If this monkey runs up the ladder, we're all going to get the shot of cold water. They start beating the new monkey to make sure he doesn't go up the ladder. What the person who's conducting the experiment did is gradually he took out all of the monkeys who had originally been tested. After a while, the last monkeys who were there, the new set of 5 monkeys, none of them know why they're beating the other monkeys. But everybody knows if you go towards the ladder, you beat the monkey. Sometimes when it comes to Western education, if we haven't revisited the idea, if we haven't thought about what our priorities are, what we're supposed to be doing right now, we might fall into the cliche. Right? Western education is important. We came here. The best schools are here. Send our kids over. Without examining the facts, just going through the motions. The mu'min's not supposed to be like that. The mu'min's supposed to be clever, wise. We're told in the hadith that the mu'min is kayyis. Some people, as parents, just go through the motions. They're not thinking about things. They haven't planned it out. Everybody's doing this, like the monkeys. Right? They said once there were these 2 old ladies and they were driving a car. Right? Little old ladies driving a car. Barely could see over the steering wheel. And they were driving, and the lady in the driver's seat looks over and she notices that they ran a red light. She's like, they just ran a red light. She says, no, maybe I'm imagining things. They go a little bit further, they run another red light. And the lady gets a little nervous. She's like, look, either I'm seeing things or something is wrong. How's it we're running the red lights? So finally, she goes over and she runs the 3rd red light, and she says, Mildred, we just ran a red light. You're going to get us killed. Mildred said, oh, am I driving? Some people are like that. They're unaware. They're just going through the motions. They don't know what's happening. As parents, we can't be like that. We have to make sure that we know exactly what's happening, what we're doing, and what we're... Right now, I want to tell you some facts about the school system that we have here to talk a little bit, engage ourselves in discussion on the thing. Now, with the school system that we have here, there's 2 problems with it. Because we're talking about preparing people for the return of the imam. There's 2 problems with the school system. One of the problems with the school system is that it's creating a sinful environment. A sinful environment. Encouraging sins. You guys are aware of how many people in the school system are actually fornicating or drinking alcohol or using drugs, right? A sinful environment. More than that, it's being encouraged. I'm sure some of you know that the sex education in the school is beginning from the from 4 years old. From 4 years old, they're teaching our children and beginning the sex education. Maybe you also are aware that many of the most generous donors to those who teach sex education are the adult industry. They're the ones who are giving the grants for the people who are working on the sex education, which then you and I, our children, are taking. Right? So the gay parade, like I'm sure you guys are aware, some of the textbooks, they don't give out to the parents. The children read the textbooks in school. The parents have no idea. You and I, we have no idea of what our children are being taught, right? But as parents, we have to know what they're being taught. We have to plan. We're trying to prepare the next generation. So what happens is, from the age of six, the gay parade, participating in the gay parade with the children, writing little things and participating, from the age of six, the way is, so that, I mean, like, and it's interesting, why is it that they're so focused on the idea of homosexuality, and why is that their red line? Why is that the thing that they draw the line on? And why is it that God on the other side is so much against it? Where do we have any situation in the Quran that God would destroy a people like he destroyed the people of Lut? And it wasn't homosexual rape. Read the ayat of the Quran. Why is it that we're so harsh on it? Why is it that they're so adamant about it? So what happens is, that kind of an environment is what the children are being put into. When an authority, a teacher, is telling you something, right? And how many hours of the day are our children in the school? Let's say 8 hours. Right? And the authorities, those who are the ones who are rewarding us or punishing us or telling us we're good or telling us we're bad, they're promoting these things or sometimes doing these things with us. They're doing drugs with the children. For instance, the other one is also dangerous. What about the idea? Sometimes it's not the sin itself. Let's say my child is able to stay away from the sin. What about the ideas that are being promoted? Now, I don't know if you youngsters, any of you can help me out. Have anybody, any of you guys remember a story about a grandpa from India, right? Grandpa Chakravarti. Didn't you guys remember that in school? None of y'all studied that? No? What happens is that in some of the schools, one of the ideas that people are being taught is that the children or the parents don't know. The parents are ignorant. The parents are backwards. In this particular story, which is part of the school curriculum, what happens is, this grandfather is a grandfather from India, and this granddaughter is over there, and she is teaching him what life is like here in Canada. So the grandfather goes over, and he's seeing, why are people dressed like this, for instance? And then the granddaughter is saying, no, we're in Canada, it's okay, people are free, people, right? Why are things like this? He's over, he's backwards, and the granddaughter is the one who's teaching him. And the message coming across is the parents don't know you as a child. You have to make decisions. You have to teach them. These are your rights, right? So what happens is, that's only one of the ideas. The ideas that are being taught, and for us, we have to make sure that our children have answers to these things. Ideas like secularism, consumerism, individualism. Part of the reason that our children sometimes are failing in their marriages is when these rapid ideas of individualism, to the extent of only my rights, what I want, how I feel, that's being promoted. And there's no focus on what my duty is, what my responsibility is, what Islam is telling you. No, what's your duty? You're in a marriage, think you're going through difficult times, what's your responsibility? Not just what are your rights. But these things, so the television, again, is problematic. These things, the ideas that are taught, these false gods, the idea, the liberalism, the homosexuality, and all of these different problems and issues are things that our children are facing. Also, another thing to keep in mind, too, for our children, is that sometimes the advice that the school counselors are giving your children, the children of you and I, is advice that will make them be part of the laborers of society. The maths that they're being recommended, these things, the counselors, sometimes the guidance that they're giving them is not such that will make our children into the leaders of tomorrow. Something just for us to keep in mind, that we don't just trust the system, or that we're uninvolved and we have no idea. They have actually stories. They said that once in the time of one of these shahs in Iran, Muzaffaruddin Shah, I believe, he was in Iran. His son, the crown prince, was being taught by a Russian teacher. So they were unhappy with the performance of the teacher. His wazir fired the teacher. And the ambassador said that, I want to speak to you. When he told him that he wanted to speak to him, he invited him. He said, look, please allow the teacher. Don't fire him. He said, no, we're unhappy with his performance. He said, even just half an hour a week. Just half an hour a week. A Again, he said, no, I'm not happy with that. I'm not satisfied. He said, I tell you what, if you allow him to teach, we will remove half of the Russian army from a city called Qazvin. And the wazir realized they had half of the Russian army in the castle by teaching the children. The values that were being taught, these non-Islamic values, what, do we believe that government should be a social contract? Do we believe in democracy as they talk it, or do we have our own stance? Do we believe in how they rationalize things, or do we have our own stance? Do we believe that truth is relative? Or do we, right? Our children need to be armed and informed. Unfortunately, what happens is many of our children who are coming out of our traditional centers without addressing these issues, they're not ready to take on these ideas and challenges. When the feminism, right, the rabid feminism, or the way that it's promoted in the schools, and the results being either that you have young men who are conformist, who are soft, who are weak, right, who believe in all of those liberal ideas, and you've turned the girls also into monsters, or you have men who come out and they're like those guys in the rap videos, they're violent, believe in raping women, disrespect it, right? These are different extremes that are coming out of this. So for us, we have to say, okay, well now, keeping these things in mind, the realities of what's going on, this is just the tip of the iceberg. The stuff that's out there about trans, and just you can talk to your children about how being transgender, and if you're transgender, can you go to the same bathrooms and these things? All of these things are being discussed. So as parents, we need to be aware of this. As children, we need to be aware of this because we want to know what's the Islamic stance. We preserve ourselves, our families, our brothers, our sisters. In addition to that, as siblings, right? And then we say, okay, well, what are solutions? One of the ideas is that there's pushback. Whenever you talk about the idea of Islamic schools, there's pushback from the community. There's different reasons that they give you. One of the reasons for pushback in the community is people say that if our children are put in Islamic schools from the beginning, they'll basically be raised in a bubble. They won't be able to interact with society at large when they come out. They've always been safe. They've been away from society. They haven't been able to go over and to interact. They're not used to these different sins that are out there, and they'll be weak when they interact. This idea comes, and there's like four, maybe five different doubts that people raise. That why shouldn't we do this, right? And one of them is that they go over and they say that how will they be able to interact with society in the proper way if you go over and you keep them in this bubble? So what happens is that for us now, when we're trying to answer this, and again, it's something that needs debate and talking, something that can't be answered in one session. Go back and forth, raise the problems and issues. Is this that what is our priority? When it comes to our children, what's our priority? Even when we're talking about integration, how do we want them to integrate? Do we want our children to integrate as leaders, to influence society, to change society? Or do we want them to be assimilated and become part of the slaves that the rest of society are? Right? Do we want them to go in strong or not? When we send our children in before they're ready, before we've taught them the word of Islam, and they haven't been exposed to us, we haven't put them in a Muslim school, the children go in unprepared. Let me give you an example. They say that if you put a frog in water and you boil the water, in the beginning, the frog will be swimming around happily. Right? He doesn't know the dangers, the changes. If you put a frog in, if you dropped him in boiling water, the frog would jump out. He would save himself. But if you put the frog in the boiling water, slowly the heat rises. The frog doesn't even know there's anything wrong. The frog's cooked. If we put it, the hadith from the Imam tells us, they say that, hasten your children to our words before, and he talks about a corrupt sect at that time, the murji'ah beat you to it. So first make sure your children have been exposed to the right thing. They've been through the process. And then after that, then expose them to the other thing. Make sure they've gone through this training. So 7 years, yes, you begin. But 7 years, what do you start with? That the idea that the person doesn't even know religion is being attacked. God is being mocked. And I'm putting this innocent child, and we know the hadith is that the child, it's like the empty field. Whatever is put in it, it takes. The other thing to keep in mind is that we're able to do this. We're not the first people to have faith-based schools. We're not the last. The Jewish community has been able to do it. The Christian community has been able to do it. Even the Sikhs, right? Non-Ahlul Kitab, they've been able to make successful schools. Their kids have gone through the schools and they've integrated into society. So the idea of that argument, the idea that we won't be able to integrate into society properly, you know, our focus should be Islam and the religion. I have verses over here of the Quran. We've just run out of time where the Yaqub would be telling his children not to die unless you're Muslims. The focus is God and Islam. The focus is not that I want you to have $1 million at whatever price. No, if you're not a Muslim, what benefit is there even to your education? So the focus now coming back on us as parents. The other one is that sometimes people will say, well, financially we're not able to. Right? We're raising our children, praying each one of them, putting them in a school, $300, $350. Let's say I have two children, three children, four children. How can I afford to put them in a Muslim school? I'm struggling. I'm barely making it here myself. There are some of our schools, even here in Toronto, that have made this commitment. They say that if a child comes and financially they cannot support themselves, they will not allow finances to be a reason that somebody is not admitted to an Islamic school. They will make a way. Other mu'mineen, other mu'minat, they have to see that, okay, if I can pay and I can put my children in, but I could also pay and help other Muslims, help other mu'mineen, help their children to go, that we make that a priority. So the idea that finances, no, there are some schools, there are options. We just have to go over and explore our options. If the idea is that I have to preserve my children, it's wajib. I'm trying to focus, like in the beginning of the talk, what's most important? What is the thing Islam wants? The focus is the youth. What do we want from the youth? Islam from the youth. The other, so the idea that that be a problem, no. But what we do as mu'mineen, as a community, is to make sure that we financially support. Right? If we see that there is an effort that's being made, we go over and we put in that money to help those other mu'mineen or mu'minat who can't. In addition to that, another question is that our children won't go to the top universities and top schools if they're put in the Muslim schools. Right? That the Muslim schools are second rate. The children who come out, they won't be able to go and achieve and go to the top universities. I want to share an experience with you from the African American community, and then after that, give you the experience that actually is happening right here in Toronto. In the African American community, we had some of the people had this experience that they would go and they would make schools for the children. These people weren't even qualified teachers. They weren't even qualified teachers. But there was love there, support there, pushing the children, motivating the children. The children were scoring so well, the government came to investigate. Why is it these children are doing so well? Just because they had teachers who believed in them, who wanted them to be well, right? Now what we have is we do have qualified teachers. We do have others who are in training. But we have to say, well, what's important to us? Do I want to make sure that my children are taught by somebody who believes in God himself? Right? Because some Muslims, when they talk about why they don't send their children to the school, they say, well, the teacher has an accent. They're a qualified person, but they have an accent. So really, has it come to that? That the accent of the teacher is more important than Islam? But again, these are things that are being mentioned. Okay? So the idea of, are there qualified teachers? Yes. Enough. We need more. If there's not the case, at least are they qualified to do this class? And then if I have to, something has to give, then what should that choice be? Should it be Islam that suffers? In addition to that, another thing people will say is, again, the fear that sometimes the commute is too far for the Muslim schools. And that's something that we have to work on as a community. If we have mu'mineen in a certain area, can we arrange for a bus? Can we move people in a certain direction? Right? If there's parents, some wives can't drive, for instance. Can we carpool? Right? That's on us now to make sure that we realize that this is something which is necessary and that we take care of it. So convenience, the idea that the schools don't have all of the facilities, that is true to a certain extent. But that's, again, on us to go over and to make sure that we pay for these things. But now, brothers and sisters, we'll have to leave that. We'll try and go briefly to Karbala. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Brothers and sisters, I'd like to, before I begin the masaib tonight, remind you of a hadith of Imam al-Ridha. He says, "Man tadhakkara musabana," whoever remembers our tragedies, wabaka, and cries because of what happened to us, this person will be with us in our level on the Day of Judgment. Assalamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifinaik عليك مني سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار ولا جعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. I'd like to remember tonight Al-Qasim, the son of Imam Hassan. He was raised by our Imam from the time that he was 3 years old. His brother had requested, Imam Al-Hassan had requested Imam Hussein to raise his children as if he was their own father. Qasim wasn't even baligh at the time of Karbala. On the night before the battle began, the Imam gathered everyone in a tent, the companions, and he told the companions that he had relieved them of their bay'ah, that they were free to go, that the enemy was only after him. The companions, when they saw this, they started insisting, saying, no, we're going to fight, we're going to defend. There's no way we can abandon you. And when the Imam saw that, and he saw their determination, then he said these words. He says, Ya qawm, fa'inni ghadan uqtal wa tuqtaloon kullukum hatta la yabqa minkum ahad. He says that tomorrow I will be killed and all of you will be killed. Allah will grant ardor, all of you martyrdom. Qasim was there when that conversation happened. He asks his uncle, he says, Ya am, O uncle, wa ana uqta? Will I be killed? Will I get that chance to become a martyr and fight in the way of God? When Imam Hussein saw this readiness in the young man, he told him, he said, Yabna akhi, kayf al-maut indak? How do you find death? And he said, oh uncle, ahla min al-asal. He said, for me, sacrificing in the way of God is more sweet than honey. The Imam saw that. He told him, yes, you're going to be amongst those men who were killed with me, but only after you have suffered a great trial and great tribulation. After the Dhuhr prayers, when all of the Ashab had been killed, now came the turn of the Ahlul Bayt. When Qasim went to speak to his uncle and asked his uncle for permission, in the beginning his uncle tried to say no. His uncle refused. They said when they were hugging each other and holding on to each other, they were crying and weeping so much that in some of the hadith it said that both of them fainted. But finally Qasim was able to get permission from his uncle. The battlefield reporters say that when Qasim came out, he was like a sliver of the young moon. This young boy, not even baligh, a long shirt on him, not wearing battle armor, carrying a sword and going out to fight. He came out and he was reciting poetry. He told them, if you don't know me, then I am the son of Hassan. In tunkiruni fa ana ibn al-Hassani. If you don't know who I am, I'm the son of Hassan. He came out and he started to fight and defend his uncle and fight for the Imam of his time. And when he did that, some of the enemy were standing. And one of them said, I will go and I will kill this man. The other battlefield reporter said, why will you do that? Leave him, the others will kill him. He said, no, I will make his life miserable. I will go over and I will attack him. So he went over to the young man who was fighting so many soldiers, and they said he hit him in the head. When he hit him, فَوَقَ الْغُلَامُ لِوَجْهِ Imam, the Qasim fell on his face into the battlefield. At that time, he finally called out for help from his uncle. Ya Amma! He called for his uncle for help. And the Imam was standing there waiting. When he saw the young man, then he came over rushing like an eagle, fighting, defending, helping. He came and he attacked the enemy who had actually hit him, and he cut off his arm. And the enemy came rushing in to save him, and they trampled the actual enemy. And then he went back to Qasim. The guy says, when I was watching, I saw Imam Hussein standing next to the head of Qasim. Qasim was in so much pain, it says, هُوَ يَفْحَصُ بِرِجْلِهِ He was over there kicking with his feet in the sand. The Imam saw him as he was about to pass, and he said that it was so difficult for me to see that you called for help and I wasn't able to help you. At that time, he prayed for Allah to destroy the people. He said, بُعْدًا لِقَوْمًا قَتَلُوكَ أَلَا لَعْنَةُ اللَّهِ عَلَى الْقَوْمِ الظَّالِمِينَ وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ